One of the most famous of the Old Testament prophets is a man by the name of Elijah. He was considered of the two prophets, or he was considered one of the two greatest, Moses being the first and him being the second. Historically, Elijah seems to sort of open the door for the prophetic era. It's not until after Elijah's time that you begin to get a lot of the written prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and all the minor prophets come after this sort of initial opening of the door by Elijah the prophet. And he kind of bursts on the scene. Chapter 17 of 1 Kings just simply says, "Now Elijah the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, 'As the Lord the God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years, except by my word.'" And that's our initial introduction to this guy, Elijah. And we have a rather lengthy section of his narratives from chapter 17 on up and through the beginning of the first couple of chapters in the book of 2 Kings. He is a rather challenging individual. Often, he is in conflict with his surroundings, with the people of God, with Israel, supposedly the people of God at that time. Elijah is in kind of constant conflict, actually. And that's one of the things that creates perhaps the drama for us, is the conflict that we read between Elijah and certainly Ahab, but Ahab representing all the people of Israel. And remember, we're talking about Israel at this point, the 10 northern tribes, the 10 tribes in the north who split off from Judah. But in fact, what we read here is basically Elijah representing God and the world represented by Ahab in conflict. Ahab, we read in chapter 16, verses 29 through 33, had led Israel into more sin than any of his ancestors. And they were pretty bad. And it says Ahab even adds to his troubles by marrying a woman who has become for us a kind of byword for evil. And that's the name of Jezebel of the Sidonians. He marries her and she brings all kinds of more evil into the kingdom. Now we simply are introduced by Elijah, as I mentioned, by his praying for famine. And that famine presents the real concern that's going on here in chapters 17, 18, and 19. Because Elijah prays for a famine, and the famine occurs for 3 years. There is no rain in the land. I've been through a couple of periods in my life when I've seen quite a few weeks. In fact, you've seen them all. There have been quite a few weeks without rain. Doesn't take long for things to dry up and turn brown, and the green starts to fade. And you have to use some sort of artificial means of watering. Artificial meaning other than rain. And more often than not, when there's not a lot of rain, towns will start rationing the watering of gardens and of lawns and so forth. I don't know about most of you, but I'm okay without having a great lawn because I don't have to cut it. Doesn't look all that great, but I usually am a little bit, I kind of don't want to water because then I just have to go out and cut it after that. But 3 years goes by. And the famine becomes very, very severe. And finally, after 3 years, the king and Elijah meet once again face to face. And the most interesting dynamic that occurs here is what they say to each other. When Ahab finally sees Elijah, he knows Elijah's sort of been the problem. And he says, "Is that you, you..." And my translation is a little different than John's. But mine says, "Is that you, you troubler of Israel?" Ahab says to Elijah. Well, Elijah returns the favor. He doesn't allow him to blame Elijah for the problem. Even though Elijah's prayed for the famine, Elijah knows something that Ahab refuses to admit. Elijah knows that he's not the problem, but in fact, Ahab is the problem. And all the idolatry that Ahab has led Israel into sin is the problem. And so Elijah turns it back on him. He says, "I'm not the problem here. You're the problem. You and your family have caused this problem." And so Elijah says, "I want you to meet me on Mount Carmel." And perhaps you know the familiar story about Elijah on Mount Carmel. He brings all the prophets of Baal together, about 400 of them, and he challenges them. He says, you get a sacrifice, and I'll get a sacrifice, and whichever God answers by fire, that's the real God. There's a kind of interesting, I think a real interesting thing that happens when he goes there, first of all. I love this. It says, so Ahab sent to all people of Israel and gathered the prophets together on Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And then it says, and the people did not answer him a word. You know, it's kind of one of those things where there's a sort of pregnant pause. You know, there's a silence that just is deafening. You know, they knew better, but they didn't want to come to grips with it. I'm going to assume most of us know the story. You know what happens. The prophets of Baal call for their God to answer by fire. He doesn't. Elijah takes the sacrifice that he has. He builds an altar. He douses it with water. And then he prays that God will answer by fire. And in fact, he does. And immediately, as soon as the people see that, they go, what have we been doing? And Elijah says, I want you to go get the prophets of Baal and I want you to kill them. And that's exactly what he does. Well, these were terrible times for Israel, were they not? Elijah prophesied during a very, very lengthy period of apostasy. As his own admission, as we are told in chapter 16, even before Elijah comes, we realize that this is one of the worst periods of apostasy in their history. Like his most famous descendant, John the Baptist, his work simply sought to turn people back to God. And I say his most famous descendant, we know that John the Baptist played the role of the Elijah that was to come, that was prophesied, that was going to come. Elijah's life was often in danger because of the stance that he took. After Mount Carmel, in chapter 19, we read that Jezebel says, I'm going to kill him. How dare him do that? I'm going to kill him. It doesn't matter to her whether or not he proved that Baal was not really God. She just says, I'm going to kill him. And this whole situation kind of poses a challenge for the faithful, does it not? How does one remain faithful during a time of immorality and godlessness without falling prey to its temptations? Is it today Christians who are the troublemakers of the world? There are some critics of Christianity who want to tell you that. Listening to some of the recent critics, Sam Harris and a few other of those individuals, you may be familiar with some of their books, you know, they think we just need to turn away from Christianity. And it's interesting to me because some of the criticisms are more like, well, we think you're ignorant and we don't like you. Which is like, it's not really a criticism of what we believe, it's just that they don't like it. They've never really come to grips with saying why it's wrong, it's just that we don't like you and it's stupid. You know, that's sort of the kind of thing that you listen to. But if you listen to them, they think we're the problem. That's not unusual. Around the time that Rome was dying, the leaders of Rome tried to blame the Christians for neglecting the gods of Rome, and that's why all the trouble was happening to them. Nero did it early on, even before Rome fell. He tried to blame Christians for his own inadequacies. That's why he killed so many of them. But I'll tell you quite honestly, we need to be able to turn the tables on society and say, it's not us, it's you. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 6, Paul says the following, and a rather challenging statement. He says, let no one deceive you with empty words. For because of these things, and these things happens to be all the sexual immorality and greed and so forth that he refers to in the previous verses, he says, because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Those are simply the people who do not follow God, who do not accept the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's the problem. The immorality that's going on in the world today, that's the problem. Paul even takes a step further in verse 11. He says, we need to expose them. We need to make them aware that they are the problem. And we don't do that out of self-righteousness, because at one time we were the problem. Each one of us was the problem, engaging in those things and living in those things. So it's not a matter of us saying to them, you know, pointing our finger or looking down our noses. It's a matter of saying, guys, you got to take a look at this honestly. This is the problem. We should not be surprised, therefore, that in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 11, Jesus will say, people will utter all kinds of lies about us. Because they don't want to hear that message. It's a difficult message to speak. It's a difficult message to hear. It's a difficult thing to admit, isn't it, that you're wrong. Or that you're the problem. And you see, this whole conflict with Elijah kind of raises the question of how are we to deal with what's going on in the world today? I have some interesting things of the reactions that I've seen. I was talking to one of the other ministers that I meet with fairly regularly. And one of the things that he was saying, their church has some sort of written ways that they're going to deal with people who want to ask them to marry them. Okay? They have some guidelines that they'll say, okay, we'll marry you if you do such and such a thing. And one of the things they tell them is, first of all, we expect you to be a church person after we marry you. Because if we're going to ask for Christ's blessing on your marriage, you know, it's not going to happen unless you start to think about your Christian faith. Second thing that they tell them is, if you're living together without being married, stop. And this one guy said, he told that to one individual or one couple, you know, recently. And the guy said, I don't think I can do that. And like he was planning to get married 3 months from now. It's like, well, I just don't think I can do that. And you see, it's shocking to people to think that maybe you ought to hold off until you get married from living together, from enjoying the benefits of marriage before you're married. I had two very similar experiences here. Quite a few years ago, actually. One person, I just decided that, well, I was kind of, when I was doing some part-time work for some place I was working for during on Saturdays, person asked me, you know, I understand you're a minister. You think you would marry us? And I said, well, come by. We'll talk a little bit about it and see what I think. Well, when I found out they were living together, I said, well, you know, that's one of the things I expect you not to do, at least before you get married. They stormed out. They were rather livid that I would even suggest such a thing. And I never saw them again. We had another individual that was coming here fairly regularly on Wednesday nights quite a long time ago. And he and I studied for a number of weeks, and he was that close. He even told me, he said, you know, I think I'm ready to be baptized. I'm ready to commit my life. And I said, well, you know, we talked about this before, and I said, you're living with your girlfriend. I said, you need to do one of two things. You need to either stop or you need to marry the girl. Because that's part of Christianity. It's part of Christian living and purity and holiness. Well, he didn't get mad, but he left and never, he said, I'll have to think about that. He must have not thought about it too long because I never saw him again. And I heard on the radio, you know, that's kind of how our society is now. It's just, well, it's no big deal. Well, it is a big deal. It's a very big deal because it strikes at just who we are. I heard a discussion on WPLJ a couple of weeks ago. Somebody had, I guess the rock singer Lenny Kravitz had put out some sort of press release that said he'd been celibate for the last 3 years. And of course, the guys on PLJ just thought that was absolutely absurd that anybody, especially in that profession, could be that way for 3 whole years. You know, they thought it was just utter nonsense. Well, that's the perspective of the world anymore. It doesn't really matter. You know, we just do those things. And nobody thinks there's something wrong with this. I mean, it would have been good. I hope Lenny Kravitz has been that way. But they didn't think it was absolute. Didn't think it was possible for anybody to do such a thing. That's the culture that we're living in, isn't it? Do we give up? Do we stand firm in our beliefs? Do we, like Elijah, get into this thinking that, well, we're the only ones left? Do we press on faithfully? I would suggest to you that in the midst of this story, there is some very, very, very good news. It doesn't seem like it at first, but there is some really good news. And the good news happens actually to Elijah himself, because in chapter 19, Elijah runs away because Jezebel wants to kill him. And he goes all the way to Mount Sinai. And when he gets to Mount Sinai, several times God asks him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he tells him basically the same thing. He says, "I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword." And that's true. They had done that. And he says, "And I, even I only am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And God tells Elijah, "Go out and stand at the mouth of the cave where he's at." And basically, he asked them the same thing. God comes by this time several ways, a storm, an earthquake, and then finally God comes in a still small voice and says, "Again, what are you doing here?" And Elijah says exactly the same thing. And by the way, let's not forget, and Elijah knew this, that one of the servants of Ahab by the name of Obadiah, and you read about him in chapter 18, had actually been hiding and feeding some of the prophets of the Lord while Elijah had been in exile for 3 years in Sidon. Chapter 18, verses 7 and following. Elijah knew that. And yet he feels like, "I'm the only one left." Well, one of the things that God does to Elijah here, he says, "All right, look, here's what I want you to do." And basically, he gives Elijah some tasks. "I want you to go and anoint this guy head over Syria, and I want you to go anoint so-and-so and so-and-so. And by the way, I want you to anoint for yourself a successor." And he finds Elisha, and he anoints him as his successor. Essentially, what God does to Elijah is, first of all, he's essentially telling him, "Don't be so self-righteous. You're not the only one left." Verse 18, "I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal and every mouth that has not kissed him." And there were some rituals they had to do in worship of Baal. They hadn't done that. He says, "You're not the only one." He says it nicely, but basically, "You're not the only one, Elijah. You know, the keys to the kingdom and what's happening in the kingdom doesn't rest on your shoulders, because I'm still at work here." And essentially, God tells him, "Just get back to work." He does it very, very gently, I think, actually. But in no uncertain terms, he will not allow Elijah to wallow in self-pity, nor will he allow him to feel that he is carrying the entire kingdom on his back. He isn't the only one faithful left, though he thinks that he is. God refocuses Elijah's energy on what he simply has to do. And implied here, you see, is the fact that God is bigger than Elijah, and that God is still at work. That's the good news in all of this. Elijah forgets the fact that he just destroyed, both physically and emotionally, he destroyed the works of Baal. Only a month and a half before he's here at Mount Sinai. It was a great victory. God is bigger than Elijah. God in this story is still at work, even though there's a tremendous amount of apostasy going on. It's one of the reasons why Elijah is instructed to anoint a successor to himself, because his work is going to continue. And when we read the Elisha narratives, which actually happen in 2 Kings, we read even greater miracles, greater things happen. Perhaps it's something that we need to kind of remember. According to 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 2, Paul tells Timothy, "Preach the word in season and out of season." Don't stop preaching the word, because people are in fact going to wander off into myths. It's just simply one of the facts of life that it's going to happen. We keep preaching because there is power in the message despite its critics. And I have a feeling over a period of time, its critics are going to find themselves alienated, because they're going to find that they really don't have anything to say other than, "Well, we don't like you and we think you're stupid." They really don't have a case for criticizing Christianity, except, like I say, they just think it's kind of stupid. I read an interesting article this week, and I'll try to be brief on this one, but it was very fascinating to me. One of the things I've read a lot on lately is this idea of intelligent design. Reagan's read a lot about it as well, and we seem to think it's pretty cool stuff. Whatever you feel about that or whatever your belief is about it is kind of unimportant at this point. The fact is, intelligent design is really simply a matter of saying there seems to be design in nature from the scientific study. It's not creationism. It's not even trying to say there's a God that exists, but just that something had to make the things that are here. And scientifically, the evidence seems to suggest that it couldn't have happened simply by itself. You may also be familiar with the case a number of years ago in Dover, Pennsylvania, where they actually tried to enforce people teaching that, and the courts outlawed them from doing it. They stopped them. Of course, the ACLU was involved and all that kind of stuff. Well, this one particular writer that I was reading suggested there was a rather interesting development that happened after that. This was in 2004 that happened, so 4 years ago. It said the same year that the ACLU successfully banned it in Dover, the highly regarded scientific journal Nature featured a cover story on a worldwide student movement called IDEA Clubs. IDEA stands for Intelligent Design and Evolution Awareness. And all they have done is say, look, we want to have some free discussion about this. And apparently since 2004, these clubs have proliferated in a number of places, not the least of which is Cornell University, where they challenged the president on some of the things that he said about intelligent design. He says, look, all we're saying is let's have some open discussion about this. So although one group tried to stop people from talking about it, apparently all it did was sort of open the door for a lot of other people to say, well, we want to talk about it. Maybe there's something here that we need to know about. And it's kind of interesting that trying to stop it actually promoted it. Well, I don't know if that's going to happen with our faith or not, but I certainly feel like that somehow God can do things that we don't think can actually happen. And you see, that's what's happening to Elijah. He thinks he's the only one left. He thinks all's gone down the tubes and the battle is over. Well, we won, but you know, they're trying to kill me. Not so. Not so. It's interesting, is it not? John chapter 11. Think about this passage for just a moment. John chapter 11, verses 45 through 52. Again, passage that was read this morning. It's interesting to me because what happens here is the leaders of the Jewish religion decide it's time to get rid of Jesus. And they think by getting rid of Jesus, they're kind of washing their hands of a big problem that they have. And the high priest says something about, you know, you guys really don't know anything because it's really better for one man to die for the people than for all of us to get killed. And what's interesting here is almost inadvertently, see, he seems to be making a prophecy about the fact that Jesus is going to die for the people. He doesn't look at it as a positive thing other than, well, you know, we're sort of getting rid of the problem of Jesus and we're also sort of getting the Romans off of our back. What ends up happening here is God uses that in a way that he never intends or expects. And that is that God uses the death of his son to bring about salvation for everyone. And I'm sure during all this time here, up until the time of the crucifixion, the disciples are, you know, hopeful, but then when the crucifixion happens, you know what happens to the disciples? They're crushed. They have no clue that this is going to bring about anything good. Their master is gone. But in fact, his death was the one thing that brought about good news for the rest of us. God was still at work in all of this. God was still bringing about his salvation, even though they couldn't see it. Just like Elijah couldn't see it, Jesus' disciples could not see it until after the fact. And John inserts this now because he's looking at it after the fact and he's going, you know, it really did happen that way. God really did bring about something great as a result of what happened there. You know, one of my favorite stories, Janet and I talk about this, is Joseph in the Old Testament, the son of Jacob. You know how he's sold into slavery by his brothers? But then when he looks back on his life after they come and the famine is real severe and they come and all his whole family is saved, it was only after looking back on it that he could see what God had done. That the bad thing of him being sold into slavery turned out to be something good. And I think we need to start adopting the same attitude. We don't know what God is doing. The church can be sure that God will do what it takes to care for us and to save us. And we need to live with the fact that we believe God is going to do that. Because God has done that in the past. And He continues to do that over and over again. This is the time to avoid the trap of self-pity. We can decide to be discouraged, or we can decide to do whatever God calls us to do and simply start doing it. This is a time, I believe, to dust ourselves off and see what we can do with God's help to move forward. This is a time to stand firm with the message that we possess. God's still at work. The gospel is still a message of hope and a message of victory. And though we go through periods when His ways are challenged and rejected, God's plan still marches on. God's critics are going to find themselves one of these days just kind of eating their words, either in this life or in the next. And I say, let us join Him in the march forward and do whatever we can to be faithful to His plan. Just as Elijah's faith was challenged despite his victory over the Baals, so too is our faith challenged by living in a world that seems intent to plunge headlong into more and more and more immorality. I say, let's rise to the challenge of being faithful in the midst of such challenging times. God is in charge, and His only Son is seated right now at His right hand.